This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, as a special Labor Day show, we hear the music of the new album, The Union Makes Us Strong, by Eli Smith and Peter K. Siegel. These are the songs that built the union movement in the United States in the first half of the 20th century. A terrific record. We'll also hear from attorney Daniel Gross and Jose Romero. Daniel and Jose are activists with the Brand Workers Organization here in New York City, using a new model to organize workers in the food processing and distribution chain. We'll also hear from Sylvia Perez and Jake Ratner, activists with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. This organization, based mainly in Florida, is using a new model to extract higher wages and better working conditions for farm laborers in Florida and around the U.S. Stay with us. New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
We have our own Michael Ratner on the phone celebrating Labor Day. But Michael, before we do any celebrations, let's talk about something extremely grave, and that's the situation in Syria. What do you make of it?
Michael, I don't get it. I mean, what was the old slogan? You can fool some of the people some of the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, here they go again on, you know, chemical weapons without any evidence, et cetera. On the other hand, apparently the American people are skeptical, if not of that, they might be because of after Iraq, but they're skeptical of going into the Middle East again with another war. So maybe there'll be a slight restraint, but it doesn't look that way. It looks like, as we speak, the aircraft carriers are off the coast of Lebanon and Syria in the Mediterranean. They're sitting there with their Tomahawk cruise missiles, and everything looks ready to go. So it seems more likely than not that we're going to see an attack of some sort on Syria. The claim is that the U.S. or the claim is that Syria somehow crossed the red line that Obama had put forward about using chemical weapons. Let's talk about that in a second, but the first thing that comes to mind, Michael, is, I don't know, you know, how many people were killed in Egypt in the last month in massacres? 1,000 more?
Yeah.
Yeah, and where's the U.S. on that? All of a sudden...
The U.S. on that is supporting the military coup behind the scenes. That's where
right.
They're at.
Exactly. So that already makes you wonder about what's really going on. But let's ask a few critical questions. One, is there any evidence, or is there evidence that's conclusive, that chemical weapons were used at all, apart from who used them? And the answer to that so far is no, there is not. There's been some speculation about it. There's been some human rights groups saying we think they were, but there's been no conclusive evidence that chemical weapons were used. And in fact, as we speak, the UN inspectors are in Syria right now, having been given permission by the Syrian government, and it's going to take them 4 days to determine whether chemical weapons were used at all. So we don't even know they were used, certainly don't have conclusive evidence from the UN that they were used or from the UN inspectors, and yet the U.S. has put its warships right up there, bellicose statements out of everybody from the president to our Secretary of State, Kerry, including an odd claim, the UN inspectors are there too late. The evidence of chemical weapons will have evaporated by the time they got there. Not true. In fact, there's actually a lot of coverage in the Times that goes back and forth, but if you read it carefully, you can see what's going on a bit. In fact, sarin, which is one of the chemical weapons they were talking about, and others, lasts for months, years, in fact, and so the U.S. claim is just complete BS that if the inspectors don't find it, it's because it's disappeared. So the first question is there yet conclusive evidence of chemical weapons? The answer to that question is no. The second question is, even if there's evidence of chemical weapons that come out of the UN inspectors or otherwise, is there any evidence that the Assad government, the current government in Syria, used those chemical weapons? Was it Assad who did it? Was it others on the side of Assad, etc.? Again, it's an assertion by the United States, the UK, perhaps France, but so far there's been no evidence of who used those chemical weapons. And in fact, there's even an article in the Times points out, always trying to cage in the article, though, why would Assad in the midst of inspectors being there, because there were some there earlier, why would he, in the face of a red line being drawn by the United States that it would bomb Syria, why would he purposely go ahead and use chemical weapons in that situation? Seems very bizarre. There's some people saying they were used by the insurgents or some part of the insurgents. Of course, the insurgents are a big mess of scores, if not hundreds of groups, many of which are affiliated with Al-Qaeda, et cetera. So even if there's evidence of chemical weapons, we don't know who's using them, and yet we see the United States saying, we're going to go in because a red line was crossed. So something else is going on here. What's going on is difficult to say, or maybe not that difficult if you read carefully. They're saying they don't want a regime change, but of course, by bombing key military targets of the Assad government, they will be weakening the Assad government and ultimately leading, conceivably, to force it to negotiate a leaving power or some kind of victory by the insurgents. In fact, another part of it looks like, as you see who the Tomahawk missiles are going to hit, it's been stated that they can't really hit the chemical weapon sites, assuming they know there are any, because that'll spread more chemical weapons. So they have to hit military who they claim are using chemical weapons, but we don't even know that. And then they say, well, maybe they'll be hitting dual use guns or you know, weapons that can actually launch chemical weapons or use them, but also have other use in the military. So in some way, they're obviously going to try and decimate Assad's military. And then you saw a piece on one of the more militant Muslim-affiliated groups, Nusra, I think it's called, probably an AQ-affiliated in some way, saying, we're getting out of here because we think, in fact, this is a conspiracy to destroy the more militant or Islamic groups in Syria, which would, of course, fit the U.S. program. So you don't know what they're going to be doing with these, except it does sound to me like tremendously weakening the Assad government and their military, as well as trying to destroy some of the insurgents they don't like. Then let's get to really, I wouldn't say the final question, but because this is an update, at least moving toward what I consider to be another key consideration here. Let's assume somehow they have evidence that chemical weapons are used, evidence which they haven't revealed to us, but perhaps, maybe speculatively, the UN inspectors will find some. Let's assume that somehow they can prove those are used by the Assad government, but of course they haven't done that. Let's assume both those things are in place. Is it legal for the U.S. to go to war against Syria, use Tomahawk missiles, which is a use of force? Is it legal for the U.S. to use force against Syria based on those two propositions? Chemical weapons were used, and they're used by the Assad government. The answer of that at current time is a clear, absolute, 100% no. There's only two ways you can make war on a sovereign country, or you can intervene in a sovereign country with the use of force. Well, one is in self-defense, and no one is arguing that this involves the self-defense of the United States. Even the Obama administration, with all its duplicity and hypocrisy, isn't saying this is self-defense. A second way you can go is if the UN Security Council gives approval for a war or use of force. In this case, the British are taking a resolution to the UN Security Council. No one expects the UN Security Council to give authority. There's Russia and China, one or both of which will probably, or a lot more than likely, veto any use of force here. So those two ways, under international law, self-defense or the UN Charter, don't fly at all here. So it's illegal under international law which is part of the U.S. law. Then you go to the second way, or the second piece of authority you need to go to war, which is our own Constitution. First, you need the UN authority, and secondly, in conjunction with it, you need our own U.S. constitutional requirements. You have to meet those. That requires Congress approve the use of force. Congress hasn't approved the use of force against Syria. There's not even an indication the U.S. Or the Obama administration will take this issue to the Congress for its approval. It's absolute for this kind of use of force, other than in imminent self-defense, that you need Congress. The U.S. will ignore that. What does the U.S. say about both these propositions, the illegality under international law, as well as the illegality under our own Constitution? Under our own Constitution, they claim, as they did in the illegal war in Libya, that they don't need it unless they put boots on the ground. And that, of course, is a complete BS argument. It was made in the Libya war. No one has accepted that argument. So it's illegal under our Constitution. And the second thing they claim under international law is that somehow getting a regional power or some kind of international group together bypasses the Security Council, and you don't need to do it. The Kosovo war, it was NATO. Afghan had did have some authority from the United Nations. But in Kosovo, it was NATO, and they're claiming that's a precedent. It's not a precedent at all. NATO can't bypass the United Nations. So you have an absolutely flatly illegal war. They're sort of making some claims about humanitarian intervention. It's called the duty to protect. They call it D2P, duty to protect, that when there's a genocide action, but no one is saying this amounts to genocide. Plus, humanitarian intervention is a very, very, very questionable theory of intervention. It's almost always used for the purposes of big power domination in a certain area. So here you have a situation. We're about to bomb a country. You have no evidence that there were chemical weapons. You have no evidence that Syria and government did it. You have no legality under the UN Charter, no legality under our own Constitution. And you really, what you're seeing is open and overt illegality in an illegal war. And you have to, in closing, put it in the context of what we've seen over the last 10, 20 years, or really forever, which is, look what we've done in the Middle East. We've gone to war with Iraq illegally, destroyed that country. We're still making war in Afghanistan, essentially destroyed much of that country. We've had an illegal war going in Yemen and Somalia for a very long time, and we overthrew the government of Libya. So you can't look at what's happening in Syria as anything to do with the, quote, use of chemical weapons. It has to do with U.S. domination in the Middle East and its continuing decisions to only support those governments that do its bidding. We're confronting something that, unfortunately, we've allowed to happen here by not having a massive, strong anti-war movement that can stop this kind of intervention and a massive, strong anti-imperialist movement in this country.
Michael, let's switch gears before I let you go and bid you a good Labor Day. Let's talk about the situation with Chelsea Manning.
Yes, I was at the trial when the judge announced a 35-year sentence. Of course, we all just were very upset, tears, et cetera. I went to the press conference afterwards in which the lawyer spoke, and it was very, very moving, talking about the 35-year sentence and his hopes that there'd be a much less of a sentence, the integrity that Manning had in doing what he did, and his hopes that he would get an early parole as early as possible, which would make a very much shorter sentence of 7.5 years, but we don't know if that's likely or not, but that's the fight. The next day after that, of course, the lawyer read a statement from Manning saying he now wanted to be known as pronoun she, her, and to be known as Chelsea Manning. We're all supporting that heavily, and the reason the lawyer said that the statement was made is because Chelsea Manning wants to receive hormone treatment and had been told that she wouldn't receive hormone treatment while in Leavenworth Prison, despite the fact that it's considered a gender identity disorder and that you should be able to get hormone treatment for that condition. The military has so far said they're not going to. At that point, Manning went public in her hopes that that she could force the prison to give hormone treatment. I think there'll be litigation. Hopefully that will happen. Meanwhile, with regard to the 35-year sentence, this is what I want to encourage all of our listeners to do, and we will link it on our website, to push President Obama to grant Bradley Manning clemency or a pardon. And that is a petition that is on the Manning website. It's called the Manning website now. You can also go to the link on our page. They're trying to get 100,000 signatures by September 20th. So let's all go to that page and see if we can get 100,000 signatures to give Chelsea Manning the pardon she deserves.
Thanks so much, Michael. We'll catch up with you next week and talk more about this issue and about Syria. Go have a good Labor Day.
Thank you for having me.
Labor Creates All Wealth was written on the banner that preceded the first Labor Day march down Broadway in New York City 119 years ago. Since then, Labor Day has been commemorated as a national holiday where people shop, barbecue, and generally have a good time. But the origins of Labor Day is what we want to talk about. The Labor Day parade came as a concession that employers, and particularly their president, Grover Cleveland, and the employers gave in the wake of the military's crushing of the great 1894 Pullman strike in Chicago. The Pullman workers built train cars that were attached to trains so that people could travel across the country and sleep. And they all lived in a place called Pullman Town, south of Chicago. Workers there derided it, called it Pull Me Down. Conditions, wages were horrific. Strike was called, led by the great Eugene V. Debs. The strike was crushed militarily with the army and militias coming in, many people killed and injured. And as a sop to the labor movement, Cleveland declared that there'd be a national holiday called Labor Day. Didn't want to do it on May 1st, which is the traditional labor holiday because of the association of May Day with the communists and the anarchists and the syndicalists. We're joined today by Peter K. Siegel and Eli Smith, who have just released a great CD of American labor songs from the first half of the 20th century. The album is entitled The Union Makes Us Strong. We talk with them about the historic and current significance of these labor songs and play three of them for you. Peter Siegel is a musician, a record producer, and a performing artist who has worked with the likes of Doc Watson, Hazel Dickens, and Roy Buchanan. He's produced a number of great albums for Nonesuch, Folkways, and Rounder Records over the last 50 years. Eli Smith is a banjo player, writer, and the promoter of both the Brooklyn and Washington Square Folk Festivals. He lives in Red Hook, Brooklyn, and is a Smithsonian Folkways recording artist. Welcome, both of you, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Thank you.
Your new CD, The Union Makes Us Strong, by Peter Siegel and Eli Smith, that's part of the reason why this is such a special Labor Day show for Law and Disorder. Before we start talking, let's play some music. Let's play one of the IWW songs written by Joe Hill, There's Power in the Union.
Would you have freedom from wage slavery and join in the grand industrial band? Would you from misery and hunger be free? Then come do your share, lend a hand. There is power in a band of working men when they stand hand in hand. That's a power that must rule in every land, one industrial union grand. Would you have mansions of gold in the sky and live in a shack away in the back? Would you have wings up in heaven to fly and starve here with rags on your back? If you've heard enough about the blood of the lamb, then join in the grand industrial band. If for a change you would have eggs in hand, come on, do your share, lend a hand. There is power in a band of working men when they stand hand in hand. That's a power that must rule in every land, one industrial union grand. Sluggers to beat on your head, then don't organize, all unions despise. If you want nothing before you are dead, shake hands with your boss and look wise. Come all you workers from every land and join in the grand industrial band. Then we our share of this world shall demand. Come on, do your part, lend a hand. There is power, there is power in a band of working men when they stand hand in hand. That's a power that must rule in every land, one industrial union grand. There is power, there is power in a band of working men when they stand hand in hand. That's a power that must rule in every land, one industrial union grand.
That was a Joe Hill song, There Is Power in the Union, played by Peter Siegel and Eli Smith on their new album, The Union Makes Us Strong. Guys, it's great to see you. Let's talk about the songs and the context in which they were written and sung. Peter, let me ask you the first question. How was it that you got to be doing this?
Well, Michael, thank you for inviting us. I've been singing these songs all my life. I grew up with these songs. My parents sang these songs. I got a guitar when I was about 13 years old, and one of the first songs I learned was Talking Union, along with Bird Dog and Don't Take Your Guns to Town. But I sang Talking Union and The Union Made, songs like that. I've always sung these songs. Now, in recent years, when the states started cracking down legislatively on unions, first in Wisconsin, then in Ohio and Illinois and so forth, I started thinking that the reporting that was coming through the media about these things didn't really explain what a union was and why there were unions in the first place, what the issues were. And I think these songs do a very clear and direct job of explaining that. And many of the issues today are still the same as they were when these songs were written. So Eli and I talked about it, and we got together and decided to make this album, and we did.
To say they're labor songs isn't enough to do justice to them. They're really songs about a great social crusade in the first half of the 20th century. Eli, what do you think the role of this music was then and is now?
Well, thank you again for having us on the show. It's an honor to be here on Law and Disorder. I guess I would say about the songs that are on this album, and there's a lot of variety on there. There's ballads that tell a story and songs that try to deliver a message that's more general. But I think one overarching aspect of the songs is that they give a feeling about what it's like to have a labor movement. I don't know if anybody was ever convinced to support a union or a labor movement just by hearing a song, but I think what these songs do is they give people a feeling and a context for what it's like to have a vibrant labor movement. And I think that's the role of culture, is to create a context and a sense of humanity in these struggles that are otherwise can be very cold and hard, mechanical in a way, just power versus power. So I think the role of the music is to give a context and a situation where people can come together to be together and sing together and have a reason to feel a brotherhood and sisterhood in the context of a labor struggle beyond just the pure mechanics of it, and also to give people now a feeling of what it was like in the past, because I think America is an amnesiac society that can't remember what happened yesterday, let alone 100 years ago when the American labor movement was really getting started. And most of the songs on our album are from 80 to 100 years ago, or even more. So I think if people hear this music, it might give them a feeling for what happened way back in the past and give them a feeling for what might happen again.
Well, 80 years ago, the mine workers were organizing down south and in Pennsylvania. The great song came out of that tremendous struggle in Harlan County that Florence Reese wrote, Which Side Are You On? And I want to now play that for the audience, and then we can have talk about it in the context of what you've just said, Eli. Thank you.
which side are you on? Don't scab for the bosses, don't listen to their lies. Us poor folks hasn't got a chance unless we organize. Which side are you on? Which side are you on? They say they have to guard us to educate their child. Their children live in luxury while ours is almost wild. Which side are you on? Which side are you on? With pistols and with rifles they take away our bread. And if you mount against them they'll sock you on the head. Which side are you on? Which side are you on? They say in Harlan County there are no neutrals there. Either you're a union man or a thug for J.H. Blair. Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Was born in Harlan County, in Harlan I was bred. When I joined the union, they said I was a Russian red. Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Workers, can you stand it? Or tell me how you can. Will you be a lousy scab or will you be a man? Which side are you on? Which side are you on? The bosses ride in big black cars while we walk in the mud. Their flag's the old red, white, and blue, and ours is drenched in blood. Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
That was Which Side Are You On? Eli, that song became not just an anthem for the labor movement in those days, but then later on, the words were rewritten, and it became an anthem for the civil rights movement 30 years later. One verse went from, they say in Harlan County there are no neutrals there. You'll either be a union man or a thug for J.H. Blair. And the civil rights movement rewrote that one, and the verse was, way down in Mississippi, no neutrals have we met. You're either for the Freedom Rides or a Tom for Ross Barnett. That was the governor of Mississippi. So these are vibrant songs that change with the times and keep inspiring in it. And what you were saying, Peter, about these songs, and you were being inspired by the big upsurge in Wisconsin, they're still singing these songs. They've rewritten the words, and they gather at the state capitol every day, and they have for 2 years, sometimes 400 people, to sing them. What were your thoughts about Which Side Are You On?
We did a version of the classic labor song anthem, Which Side Are You on our new album, The Union Makes Us Strong. That's just come out. And it's a song that was written by Florence Reese, and it's really in a traditional style from the heart of Appalachia in the coal mining region. And we rendered it in a way that's as authentic as we can be to that style. I played it on the banjo in the style of Doc Boggs, who was a coal miner and a union man way back in the early 20th century. And I think it is a classic song that how much more stark can you get? Which side are you on? And there was no one that had a more intense experience of that than the songwriter herself, Florence Reese. And if you want to hear her sing it, she's actually in the film Harlan County, USA, that Barbara Koppel did way back. And Florence Reese is an old lady at that time in the film, but it's really pretty powerful to see her sing it. The bosses ride in big black cars while we walk in the mud. Their flags, the old red, white, and blue, and ours is dripped in blood. And to me, I guess that's both dripped in blood because of the terrible repression that was suffered by the miners during that strike, but also because their flag is the red flag, the communist flag.
That song was written in the 30s and sung in the strike in the 30s. And then when Barbara Koppel made her movie, the class struggle was still ferocious down in Harlan County in Kentucky. It was wonderful to hear that song sung again. And, you know, we had a guest on the show a few months ago, and the mountaintop removal that they're doing in Kentucky is being done by the Blair Corporation. So what do you have to do?
No kidding.
Drive a wooden stake through their hearts, you know?
Michael, one of the contributions of that song is to sharpen the distinction between two sides and make it clear that you're either part of the problem or part of the solution. That's a theme which has informed the labor movement and the great struggle for social justice. Martin Luther King talked about the hottest places in hell being reserved for those who, in times of crisis, do nothing. I think it's a challenge to the listener as well. Which side are you on?
Yeah, absolutely. I remember the IWW, which Joe Hill was a member of and which Mother Jones founded, and we're going to get to Mother Jones in a minute. But the IWW was formed as like the left-wing militant wing of the labor movement in 1895, and the preamble to the IWW Constitution says, "The working class and the employing class have nothing in common." So with that, and with your permission, let's go to the song about Mother Jones and talk about the song and talk about her once we've heard it.
Champion of labor was known in every land. She fought for right and justice. She took a noble stand. Of every danger, she hated that which was wrong. She never gave up fighting until her breath was gone. This noble leader of labor has gone to a better land, while the hard working miners, they miss her guiding hand. May the miners all work together to carry out her plan and bring back better conditions for every laboring man.
That was The Death of Mother Jones, Eli Smith singing it from the new album that he and Peter Siegel did, The Union Makes Us Strong, which is available on the internet. Just type in The Union Makes Us Strong, Peter Siegel, Eli Smith, and they'll tell you how to get it. But let's talk a little bit about Mother Jones, because that's such an extraordinarily moving song. You know, Mother Jones died when she was 100 years old. She was a founder of the IWW. She started out not as a union activist, but as really a wife and a mother. And she lost her husband and her children in a great flu epidemic. Willy-nilly got involved with the anthracite coal miners in Pennsylvania. There's a great story about her that Cliff Connor tells in his liner notes to your album, The Union Makes Us Strong, where Mother Jones is riding in a buggy with a horse wearing a full gingham dress, and some thugs try to stop her, and they grab the bridle of the horse, and she pulls out a pistol from under her dress, and she points it at the guy, and she says, "Let my horse go." And they let her go. She was truly a noble leader of labor. What was it like for you guys to discover that song?
Peter, you brought in that song when we were making this album.
The first time I heard it was on a wonderful album by John Greenway called...
That's right, The Folklorist.
Called American Industrial Folk Songs. That was 50 years ago. They used to have these things called LP records. That was a theme of this album, great songs. As I got more interested in different kinds of folk music and old-time music and country music, I discovered that that song had, in fact, been recorded by Gene Autry. It was one of his very first records. Gene Autry started out sort of as a Jimmy Rogers imitator. He's quite good.
He was known as the singing cowboy.
And that was one of his very first songs. I don't think Gene Autry had a particular connection to that song. He apparently got the song from OK Records, which was his label. They had found the song and gave it to him as an artist, and he sang it and made a very beautiful record of it, which is the basis of our rendition of it. There's a steel guitar on that record, and Eli plays a slide guitar on our record, sort of inspired by that, I think. And Eli sings it beautifully. And we have a wonderful musician with us on that song, Andy Statman, the great mandolin player.
He is truly a great mandolin player. For that mandolin playing alone, I would recommend this album. But I'd recommend it for several other reasons as well. One is that you're a good friend of mine, Peter, and Eli Smith, you're my son. And secondly, it's a terrific, musically speaking, it's a terrific album. You can get it. It's called The Union Makes Us Strong, Peter K. Siegel and Eli Smith. Just look it up on the internet and you'll figure out how to buy it, like on CD Baby. The Union Makes Us Strong. Just for the liner notes itself is a wonderful historical record. The photographs, but the music especially, has got some of the best musicians in the country on it, and I can't recommend it highly enough. The Union Makes Us Strong.
This album has been a pleasure for us to make, and it's been a really great project and a way that we hope we can give back a little bit as musicians to the American labor movement. And I hope that for people that might have an interest in it, in the album, it's a way for people to hear these songs, which are quite old and often on old scratchy records that are hard to find and hard to hear. I hope that people will find a way to feel this music as a living music and as a genuine part of American history, which is often overlooked and not easy to locate. So I hope that people will enjoy the music on The Union Makes Us Strong.
I have nothing to add to that. That's perfect, Eli. Thank you, and thank you, Michael, so much.
Well, thank you, Peter, and thank you, Eli, for being on Law and Disorder. We're joined this morning by Daniel Gross, an organizer and workers' rights attorney. He's the founder and executive director of Brand Workers. Brand Workers is based in New York City. It helps food production and distribution workers develop their own direct action campaigns to overcome wage theft, anti-immigrant abuse, and reckless disregard for worker health and safety. Daniel is the co-author with Stoughton Lind of Labor Law for the Rank and Filer, Building Solidarity While Staying Clear of the Law, and the other book, Solidarity Unionism at Starbucks. As a Starbucks barista in 2004, Daniel co-founded the IWW, that's the Industrial Workers of the World Starbucks Workers Union, which continues to break new ground in fast food organizing outside of formal government certification or employer recognition. Daniel Gross, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Great to be here, as always.
The brand workers model, how you work with workers to facilitate their helping themselves make things better, or at least a bad situation a little less bad, is a new model. And it's not like anything that we've been used to in terms of organizing for a contract, get the contract, work according to the contract, make grievances, and so on. I want to ask you why, but I want you to give our listeners some background to what happened to the union movement. It gained such strength over the first half of the 20th century. It's so enfeebled now that's caused brand workers to try to use a new model. But let's talk about the old model, about organizing a union, getting a contract, and trying to improve wages and working conditions. What happened?
The organizing model that inspires our approach at Brand Workers actually really found its beginning in the late 19th century, in the early 20th century, and it's simple. It's a unionism that's worker-led and worker-operated, and that's the fundamental thinking behind what Brand Workers is accomplishing today, and we think that was the right logic for the labor movement. Unfortunately, labor went a different direction. And moved into, as is well known now, a system very much based in the National Labor Relations Board and the National Labor Relations Act, which is based on folks not regularly employed at the job doing the sort of representational activities, as it's called. Now, that approach worked for several decades. Labor identified itself as having a seat at the table with government and business, and frankly lost its sense of being a fighting movement. As many predicted, that arrangement between labor and capital and government wouldn't hold, because business and government understood that it was really just a temporary cessation in full hostility to workers' right to organize. And what we've seen now is the NLRB system.
Daniel, you're here this morning with your colleague and comrade, Jose Romero, who's a food worker here in New York City. I wanted to ask Jose, because he's been involved in these campaigns. Jose, I understand that you were involved in the FLAM campaign. Can you tell us what you were doing and how it worked out?
Bueno, sí, yo estaba trabajando en FLAM. Empecé a trabajar ahí en
My los... work was to cook and prepare vegetables and different things like horseradish and chickpeas.
What were the grievances that workers had against FLAM? I guess chickpeas they make hummus out of. What kind of company was this to work for? What was wrong with this place?
Es una compañía judía.
It was a kosher factory. We were working very long hours without being paid overtime. There was really no benefits, including no vacations. We really had very little.
You guys got together and decided to do something about it. Talk to us about that.
Bueno, sí. Un día ya les despidieron a una de nuestras
compañeras. The retaliation started one. Compañera Maria Corona, who had two kids who she needed to get to school. And just for that reason, you know, she had to come a little bit late.
And they fired her?
And she was fired, yes.
So what'd you do about it?
Bueno, en ese entonces...
we decided we had to come together. We had to unite, because otherwise we would all get fired. For frivolous reasons, like having to bring your kids to school and being late 10 minutes one day.
So what was it like the first meeting you had? What'd you talk about and what'd you decide to do?
We decided
to unite and we came together one day during our break. We all met on the patio and we decided that we were going to confront the boss, all of us together.
What did you tell him? Did you tell him how does the song go? That it's going to be mighty lonesome for you if we all decide to walk out?
Maybe it wasn't the best idea in the sense that we had particularly complained about a particular manager, and that really increased his hostility towards us.
So what happened next?
pues el manager nos
So this manager and would attack us, would yell, would call us cockroaches, would hurry us and call us stupid, and was pushing for more work in less time.
And whatever happened to this manager?
Bueno, nunca fue despedido.
The manager stayed on, but what happened was we met organizer Billy Randall at that time, and he helped us open our eyes. He helped open our eyes.
We're speaking with Jose Romero from Brand Workers and Daniel Gross from Brand Workers, and we've been talking about a campaign they ran against the Flaum company, manufacturer of hummus, and it was a resounding success. I remember the campaign, and I wanted to ask you, Jose, what were the highlights in terms of what you won after this campaign against Flaum?
Pues,
what I liked most is that justice was done, that he wasn't able to prevail about us. This wasn't about the money. It was about our treatment, and it was about the treatment of all immigrants and the treatment of future generations.
Daniel, Jose, we're running out of time, but I wanted to ask you for your last reflections on this Labor Day. If you had a message from your experience to share with our listeners about how to fight back, what would you say?
Pues,
be informed of your rights. Know that you have rights whether or not you have documents. It's important to know that and never give up. Never stop fighting.
Jose Romero, those are words to live by. Thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder. Daniel Gross, thank you so much. Have a good Labor Day.
Thank you.
This year's Labor Day, farm workers with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers travel across Florida, calling on the public supermarket chain to join the Fair Food Program. Who are the Coalition of Immokalee Workers? They're a Florida-based community organization of mainly immigrants from Latin America and the Caribbean, including Mayan Indians and Haitian immigrants, who have been working low-wage jobs throughout Florida. These farm workers routinely face a number of different kinds of exploitation, poverty, wage theft, physical and verbal abuse, as well as sexual harassment in the fields. Their campaigns focus on the big corporate buyers of the produce that they pick. They started with Taco Bell, and from there launched campaigns against McDonald's and Burger King. Since then, 11 companies are cooperating to improve the wages and working conditions in the food supply chain. We're joined today by Sylvia Perez with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. Our translator, Jake Ratner, is Michael Ratner's son. He's traveled and studied in Cuba and Bolivia, and he now works with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. Sylvia, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Sylvia, I wanted to start off by asking you, what was it like to be an agricultural worker, and how did you get involved with CIW?
Pues la experiencia para una mujer en el campo es muy difícil, porque tenemos que hacer el mismo trabajo que hacen los hombres.
And so my experience is first as a woman working in the fields, and it's been very difficult for me. We often do the same work that men would do in the industry.
And how are you treated differently?
Porque antes...
Well, first there are the conditions that all farm workers face, regardless of gender, and that's conditions that range from heat exposure and having to work long hours under the Florida sun, and also historically having to overfill our buckets to heap extra tomatoes on top, for which we were not paid.
And at the end of the day, before the Coalition of Immokalee Workers got involved, how much would an average worker make?
For many years before the CIW began its Fair Food Program, farm workers were paid just around an average of 45 cents per bucket. And that's been the same wage that farm workers have received in the tomato industry in Florida for more than 30 years, just 45 cents for a 32-pound bucket of tomatoes.
So how many hours a day would you have to work? And at the end of the day, how much money would you make?
And so in the industry, we're paid by the piece. And so it would range depending on the season, and every day it would be different. So sometimes we would enter the fields at 1 hour and leave early, or other times we'd be there all day working. But you're paid by the piece for how many buckets of tomatoes you end up picking.
So there's no guaranteed daily or weekly wage.
No hay una garantía de un salario.
No, no hay garantía de un salario porque te pagan la cantidad que haces.
And so the way it worked in practice was that, no, there was no guaranteed wage that we would receive for our work in the fields. We were just paid that 45 to 50 cent average bucket rate. While there should be a minimum wage and we should be legally guaranteed to be paid that minimum wage, oftentimes we did not receive it.
When and how did you get involved with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers in Florida?
So I began to be involved in the Coalition of Immokalee Workers in 1994 when they were just getting started because they would hold weekly meetings here at their community center in Immokalee, and they'd also hold women's group meetings every Sunday in which I participated.
How have things changed from when you started to now in terms of the wages and working conditions of agricultural workers in Immokalee, Florida, the ones that pick the great majority of tomatoes that are grown in the United States?
With our campaign for fair food, which brought on board now to date 11 major corporations throughout the entire United States, which are participating, we developed the Fair Food Program, an initiative which is a partnership between farmers, farm workers, and the major retailers. And because of that program, things are changing a lot, and many of the basic rights that we were not guaranteed before are now being respected.
Sylvia Perez, you organized the Coalition of Immokalee Workers on a wholly different model, say, than your traditional trade union. And can you explain to our listeners why that model is different and how you do it?
So our organization is not a union. We are a worker-based organization and a community-based organization that was formed by farm workers themselves. Many farm workers came from Guatemala, Mexico, Haiti, and other parts of Central America, and they themselves began to come up with the solution to the problems that they were facing in the industry. Farm workers are actually not allowed in many states, including Florida, to have the rights that many other workers in other industries are guaranteed, like the right to collectively bargain. And so the CIW created a different model.
There's a campaign that the CIW is running in Florida against this vast supermarket chain called Publix. And then there's another campaign that's nationwide against Wendy's, the hamburger stand. But first, let me ask you about Publix. I read that Publix has charged the CIW campaign as being, quote, a socialist curse on the industry. And my question is, what are you doing to elicit such a excited condemnation?
And so that's exactly right. In addition to our national campaign with Wendy's here in the Southeast for more than 4 years, we've asked Publix Supermarkets, the largest Florida-based corporation and a huge supermarket here in the South, to come on board, as 11 other companies have, and join the Fair Food Program. And specifically, what we're asking them for is really just two things. One, that they pay 1 penny more per pound for all the tomatoes that they're buying to go directly to farm workers. And two, to respect our rights, to agree to only buy from farms that can demonstrate that our code of conduct or a set of basic rights is in place. And those rights include things like the right to work free of sexual harassment, zero tolerance for modern-day slavery, and extremely importantly, the right for farm workers to have a voice, to be able to bring up abuses when they occur and know that they will be dealt with. Otherwise, farms face the market consequences. But Publix has refused to do just that.
Let's turn our attention to Wendy's. I was at a demonstration 2 months ago when their national board met in Midtown in New York City. And Wendy's, of course, is like the lesser McDonald's, and they use a lot of tomatoes on their burgers. CIW has a campaign against Wendy's. Can you tell us what you're doing in the campaign and how our listeners might be able to help you?
Wendy's, that's right, buys a lot of tomatoes that they use on their hamburgers. And during the growing season, the majority of those tomatoes come from Florida, come from the farms in which we work. And we're asking the same thing of Wendy's. We're asking them for all of their Florida tomatoes to pay that 1 penny per pound, which would greatly lift worker wages. And we know that Wendy's is the one who are benefiting from our labor. We know that Wendy's are making the largest profit from the incredibly hard work that we do. And so we're asking folks nationally to get involved with our campaign against Wendy's, to call on the corporation to join the Fair Food Program. And there's lots of ways people can get involved. You can visit our website and find out how to take action. But we also, like you said, hold a lot of different actions around the country. We were just recently at the Wendy's shareholder meeting in New York, and we just held a day of action in August in which dozens of cities held protests calling on Wendy's. We'll continue holding actions like this in the future and asking Wendy's to come on board.
Sylvia, what's your website?
Ahorita le vamos a explicar un correo que le podemos donde nos pueden escribir.
The website for the Coalition of Immokalee Workers is easy to remember. It's just www.ciw-online.org. That's www.ciw-online.org.
Well, Sylvia Perez, I want to thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder. And Jake Ratner, I want to thank you for your good work and your excellent translation. Good luck to you both and a happy Labor Day.
Thank you.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.